Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. We'll get an update about things happening at the library with Beth Weigel. Lena Simmons will be here to highlight the Midsummer Vocal Festival. We'll meet Zachary Hinch and Julie Diana, new staff members for the Juno Dance Theater. And we'll hear about art happenings in Juno during Arts Up. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music and more on a Juno Afternoon. It's next. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new era in elementary education is beginning at Isleta Pueblo. According to tribal leaders and school and federal officials, this month the New Mexico tribe officially celebrated taking over operations of Isleta Elementary School from the federal government. Isleta Pueblo Governor E. Paul Torres says the plan is to create a learning environment to ensure students succeed well after their elementary education at Isleta. One of the challenges, he says, the school faced was high turnover in staff.
We have hired new teachers. We have a new principal. We are going to focus on culture, tradition, and language, and the other curriculum that the kids need to have in place to learn.
Generations of Isleta community members have attended the school under Bureau of Indian Education control since the late 1890s. Many are looking forward to the transition.
I believe it's a good, positive move for the future of our children. Education has always been a priority.
Parent Geraldine Hohola, like many tribal members, attended the school, as well as her four children. Three have already graduated from the elementary school, and one is starting fifth grade this year.
We need to find what best fits and best suits our students. And from a parent perspective, you know, I would like the education system to fit the needs of my child. And I believe now with this transition and this conversion, it will allow us to expand and bring what's valuable.
Federal officials say Isleta can be a model for other tribes wanting to take over BIE operations. Three other pueblos in the state have already made the move. Nationally, BIE Director Monty Russell says this year two schools in Arizona converted, with many other tribes inquiring.
The obvious benefit is that it's their future, it's their nation, it's their kids. Every tribal leader that I've spoken with, they talk about high academic standards, not lower academic standards. And on top of that, they talk about tribal standards, tribal language, tribal history, tribal culture. And that's what really is important, is that these kids today understand who they are. Research study shows that kids who understand who they are and have an understanding of their culture and history do better in later years in college and academic success. So it just makes perfect sense that they would want to take control of their schools.
Russell was among federal officials on hand for the Isleta School celebration, along with the U.S. Interior Secretary and the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs. Isleta will still receive federal government support. New Mexico U.S. Senator Martin Heinrich, who was at the event, says he'll continue to back federal funding for Indian education.
We have been underfunding education, and specifically, if you look at BIE, the Bureau of Indian Education, historically, funding there has not grown at the same rate as the Department of Education because of its historic place in the federal budget under Interior, and we need to begin to make that right, and sequestration has only compounded those problems.
Tribal leaders, officials, and community members marked the reopening of the school on August 1st with a ribbon-cutting ceremony.
Everybody got their scissors ready? Ready?
The tribe would like to see 150 students enrolled by the start of school August 10th. The Shakopee Mittewakanton Sioux community and the American Heart Association announced a partnership today. The Minnesota tribe and the organization are teaming up to develop a national framework to help improve nutrition among Native Americans. The announcement follows the launch in March of Seeds of Native Health, the tribe's initiative to improve Native American nutrition. According to the tribe, a new report details there's a dietary crisis facing many Native American communities. A national meeting is planned for October in the Twin Cities. Discussions are looking at research, education, policy changes, and community-driven strategies. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by United Tribes Technical College, offering courses online for a career in medical coding and for updating your current coding certification. Registration available through August 10th online at uttc.edu.
KNBA and Recover Alaska are seeking inspiring stories of recovery from alcohol addiction. If you or someone you know would like to share a story of recovery as part of an upcoming online and on-air documentary video project, go to knba.org and click Tell Your Story.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to A Juno Afternoon. Lori Scandling here. Our producer, Jeff Brown, is also in the studio. Let's take a quick look at our weather. Showers diminishing late tonight, lows around 53. East wind 10 in the evening, becoming light and variable. Tomorrow, though, rain likely in the morning and then scattered showers in the afternoon. Highs will climb up to around 62 with some light winds. We are looking for a little bit better weather on the weekend, where the chance of rain declines to just that, just a chance. Stay with us today. We have an interesting program planned. Our first guest today are Beth Weigel, who is the program coordinator for Capital City Libraries, and Andy Hirsch, whose role is head of electronic services and community outreach. As we said, kind of a mashup of a couple big roles. Thanks for joining us. This is an exciting month for the library system in Juneau.
That's right.
Yeah.
The big news is the big move, but let's talk about that in just a moment. First, what's up with some of your summer programs, Beth? I imagine it won't be long till they come to conclusion. School starts in just a couple of weeks.
That's right. So we're wrapping up our summer reading program. If you're still wanting to get involved with that, you can still do a couple of the games. You got to pick up those reading logs by the end of this week and then get them turned in within the next 2 weeks. So we'll accept those, and we're handing out some of our last prizes for the reviews this week. And we still have the Local Heroes walking tour happening later in the month through the museum. We still have a Books and Bullwinkles teen program happening on Tuesday, August 18th, where we'll draw the winner for our teen reviews as well. And I think Andy still is accepting her adult reading program.
It's true.
Blogs, right?
Yes, adults have to read or listen to 4 books over the course of the summer and fill out a small form, and they can get entered into a prize drawing.
So still can participate in some of the games, but we're wrapping up all the rest of the programming. We'll finish up doing our summer reading program special story times, where we have a craft and whatnot this week. Friday will be the last story time in the Valley Library in the mall. So that'll be our final program then. Our third Thursday family time will be saying goodbye to our Valley Library. And we'll be taking a little break from our story times and toddler times for the next 3 weeks as well, as we get ready to make a transition to move into the school year as well as move into our new library in the Valley.
How long has the branch in the Valley been in the Mendenhall Mall?
It's been the temporary location for 33 years.
Ready to move any minute.
We are.
This is it, though. When is the ceremony to welcome, christen, celebrate the new library there at the Diamond Park area?
We haven't set an exact date for our grand opening celebration, but we believe it'll be in early November, although we will get, hopefully, the library open before then. We're making a slow transition, or, you know, a medium to slow transition from the old library to the new library. We're going to close down at the Mendenhall Mall on August 31st at 8 p.m. at the Mendenhall Mall, and we'll start moving all 44,000 books, videos, games, all those pieces over to the new library. And we can talk a little bit about how everyone out there can help us do that. And then as soon as we can, we'll reopen. So it may be late September, but we're feeling fairly certain it'll be by the beginning of October.
Sounds like there will be a bit of a hiatus then during the transition.
Right. So we will have both the Valley Library and the Mendenhall Mall and the new library closed during that transition in September.
So last day of August is the last day for that site. How is it that the public can help? What should they know about the move?
Well, there's a couple different ways that people can help. The first thing is we're extending the checkout dates for all of the Valley items. So in the month of August, if you check out something from the Valley, it won't be due till October. And we're doing this in the hopes that you will check it out from the old Valley Library and return it to the new Valley Library. And every book that you check out and take is helpful for us, because that means maybe we don't have to move 44,000 items. So we are extending the checkout dates. We are asking people to come in and maybe take one or two extra books. And then we're also doing a program where you could be a checkout champion, and you can check out up to 40 items, which is the maximum your library card will allow, and take them from the old Valley Library and return them to the new Valley Library. And if you do that, you'll get entered to win a prize.
Do you want people to help you that weekend, or is there a special time when you're going to organize a work party for those who maybe don't want to haul a book home, but they'll haul it down the street for you, anything like that?
While we would normally, in other circumstances, we have encouraged the public, but in this case, we're not going to. So it's going to be a lot of heavy, repetitious movement, and we feel that having library staff do it will make the process easier, faster, and more efficient.
And make all of you a lot stronger in the way.
I'm going to be so good at push-ups.
So let me ask you this. I'm going to assume there are some items that might never be checked out. Will there be things that will be discarded? Is this also a house cleaning process? And how do you go about making those decisions?
We've been doing that for the last 6 to 8 months. So what we do is we run reports using our system, and any book that or item that hasn't been checked out in 5 years, nobody has wanted it in 5 years, so we pull it from circulation. So we've actually been working on that pre-move. So anything that is still there August 31st, when we close, we'll be moving into the new branch.
Right, and this is a good time, too, because we've been doing all these weeding projects, to check out some of those items over at the Friends of the Juneau Public Library's amazing bookstore. A lot of those items go over there, so it's a big, you know, bonanza of things at the Friends right now.
If people have not visited the Friends of the Library, it's over by Alaska Industrial Hardware, which is quite near the airport, and it is a wonderful shop, and this leads me to thinking about the funding of the new library, because I know Friends of the Library gave, I think, a total of $1 million at least.
Go ahead, Andy. I apologize for interrupting. They actually gave a little bit more than that. So they gave $1.18 million from the Friends, and then they also gave an additional $300,000 from an endowment fund. But that wasn't the Friends.
And what is the total cost of the new library? Let's look at that and do a little comparison in terms of the facilities that the public will now be able to access compared to where it has been.
Sure. The cost of the entire system, building the library was $14 million. $7 million of that came from a grant from the state of Alaska. $4.7 million was through the 1% sales tax that CBJ has already approved and everybody has already paid for. The Friends gave some money, and then the rest of the money was made up through grants and endowment funds for that. And so in exchange, we're getting a much, much nicer facility. So it's going to be twice as large. It's going to have a lot more meeting rooms and public spaces. So in the Mendenhall Mall, there's one meeting room. You better hope it's not booked. In this one, we're going to have a large meeting room, a small meeting room, and 4 study rooms for people to use. We're having a much expanded and beautiful children's area, which includes, I think, a small stage for story times and for programming. We have a quiet reading area. We have loud areas. We have more computers.
The teen room as well. We'll have a room dedicated to teen programming.
What will that be like?
Well, we don't quite know yet, but
maybe teens can program it for you.
Yeah, and that's part of the hope. We do have a teen advisory committee that works with Amelia Jenkins, one of the youth services librarians, and she's responsible for the books in Bullwinkle. So if you have an interest in helping us plan out what's going to happen in that new space, that would be a great time to check in with her. Come to that Books and Bullwinkles, and you might just win a prize there, too.
You know, listening to you, it sounds like you're building a community center, and I don't mean this to be provocative. I'm a huge reader. Jeff and I were talking about that right before we went on today. But why is it that libraries are pertinent anymore? When I can sit on my couch and on my laptop, I can learn anything, I can read anything, I can download almost anything. Talk a little bit about why we need bricks and mortar to have books, to have literature, to have the kinds of experiences that you're describing.
Sure. I would love to talk about that. So first I'm going to discuss the idea that you can get online and download anything. And so that's actually not true. So there's only a small percentage of books that have ever been uploaded online that are available for download. And there's a much smaller percentage that are available to the public for free. And that's one of the great things that the library does, is they provide services and access to resources. So if I wanted to write a book or read a book or do some research, I might have to spend hundreds or thousands of my own dollars to download every book that I want. Instead, I pay a small amount in my taxes, and everybody gets to share this awesome community resource. So that is one of my favorite parts of the library, is that it's all about access for everyone, for people who can afford things and can't afford things.
Beth, you want to add to that?
Well, and I was going to say, too, the library really does fill a bit of a gap in our community, in the sense that, yes, maybe those of us sitting around right now here in the studio have the means and the resources to purchase books or download books for our cost, but there's a lot of people in our community that don't. And I know, for example, Andy works at the homeless shelter and at different outreach sites where the people don't have that same, affluence to be able to afford to download and buy books and things like that. We still, people who are still using older technology and haven't upgraded because they don't have those means either, we still can provide things like video, VHS tapes and cassette tapes and DVDs, which are very quickly becoming obsolete too with streaming. But those are still things that people can put their hands on and take home and use as resources. And it's also a beautiful place. I've seen so many different programs come together, being the program coordinator, where we're able to discuss issues that are important to our, civic duties. We did a course recently on how to run for public office, mm-hmm. and we've done a lot of programs around, making sure everyone knows the issues and who's running for office, being that entity that doesn't, promote any certain party or person or anything like that or platform, but just having access to those people and access to ask your questions when things are coming up, when they're talking about making changes to the bus routes or anything like that. It's a space in which the community can come together and have that conversation. And, there's very few places that we have that are public places for public discussion.
A true gathering place mm-hmm. in many ways. I know that there has been set aside a budget of about $100,000 to purchase additional materials for the new library. And I'm going to assume a lot of those will be books. But can you briefly tell me how you decide what to buy, what to order? What are the the measuring sticks that you use to say, I think someone will check this out in the next 5 years.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to talk about that. So we have kind of two different processes. One is we seek community feedback. So if somebody comes to us and says, I want a book, we have forms online, we have forms in the library, and people can submit requests. And we almost always buy the requests. Generally, we don't buy them when we can't get a copy of them. Other than that, most of the time, we are able to add them to the collection. And for books that don't come in through patron requests, we actually have two different committees. We have a youth services and an adult services committee. And what we do is we look at publications in the library field that review upcoming books and media, so books, audiobooks, DVDs, things like that. And what it does is we look at a whole bunch of them, and we read a lot of reviews, and we look and see what's popular, and we get together and we say, I think it's really important that we have a book on this issue because we have a book on the opposite side of that issue. Or, oh, this author's really popular right now. We need to make sure we have enough books by that person. And so we get together every month and we look over hundreds and thousands and thousands and thousands of book reviews that other people have written and read. And that's one of the ways we make our selections.
Interesting. Well, we've been talking with Andy Hirsch, who is the Electronic Services and Outreach Coordinator for the Capital City Libraries, and Program Coordinator Beth Weigel. And we've chatted a little bit about the winding down of the reading programs for this summer and a lot about the new library, which, if I understand correctly, will have a soft opening at least probably sometime in November.
Well, soft opening probably by the beginning of October.
Beginning of October. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that correction. And the Mendenhall Mall site will close the last day of August, so there will be a one-month period when there will not be a Valley Library open per se.
That is correct, and I would like to encourage everybody. The other two public libraries will still remain open, and people can use the UAS Egan Library or the State Library. Everybody's cards work at every location.
It truly is a capital city system.
Right. And if anybody has a question about picking up their holds, which they normally get at the Valley, feel free to call us, as well as both the book drop at the Valley Mendenhall Mall location and our new location in the Diamond Park location will be open to return your books through the book drop. So you can still return books in the Valley. And then if you have any questions about picking up holds and things like that, just give us a call.
Why don't you give the key phone number and your website?
Sure. Our main branch is 586-5249, and our website is juno.org/library.
juno.org/library. And don't forget, if you want to help move those books, you can check out up to 40 from the Mendenhall Mall and return them to the new facility about a month later. Thank you for joining us today. I want to remind you, if you're out and about this evening, 9 o'clock tonight at the Rendezvous is the Cajun Country Revival. You can bring a little sunshine into your Thursday by dropping by there at 9.
Saturday, August 29th, the Diamond Park Aquatic Center will be hosting the annual Race Back to School Triathlon for children in grades 1 through 5. Check-in is at 8 a.m. with the race beginning at 9 a.m. and entails a 50-yard swim, 1-mile bike ride, and half-mile run. Registration materials available at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center. More information at 586-2782.
Well, that music will get you up out of your chair. So if you are up out of your chair around 9 o'clock tonight, drop by the Rendezvous to hear the Cajun Country Revival. Thanks for sticking with us on this Thursday afternoon. Lori Scandling with you. Jeff Brown, our producer, also in the studio. Joining us now is Lena Simmons. She's the producer of the Midsummer Vocal Festival. And with us also Byron McGilvray, who is the conductor and the artistic director of this program. Lena, what is the Midsummer Vocal Festival?
Well, Midsummer Vocal Festival started as an opportunity for choral singers to get together and sing a major work that you wouldn't do here. You know, if you're the opportunity to sing in a big choral group isn't available readily in Juneau. And so we wanted to do something big. Our first year we did the Brahms Requiem, and then we did the Mozart Requiem. And this year we're doing Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, which is just one of those very exciting, pulsating, barbaric.
What more could one ask for?
What more could one ask for? A little risque at times, you know, work, which was written in the 1930s. The music was written in the 1930s, but the poetry all comes from medieval monks and troubadours and whatever, and it's all about wine, women, and song.
If you know Latin, you'll know it's about
Latin,
wine, women, and song.
Bastardized Latin and bastardized German and bastardized French.
Now, so, I know that the culminating performance is this Saturday night at 7:30 at the Thunder Mountain Auditorium, if
mm-hmm.
I, but the practice, the preparation has been going on for
2 weeks.
Like a couple of weeks. That's
mm-hmm.
a major commitment from people, particularly because there have been some sunny evenings.
And, you know, they've all showed up. And we've had great attendance, you know. It's exciting to sing. It really is exciting to sing. So that helps a lot. And when you get two pianos and three percussionists with 10 different types of percussion sitting on the stage, you know, it's pretty cool.
How many participants do you have?
We have about 50 singers and two pianists, because we have two pianos on stage. And we have three percussionists who are playing... Oh, help me, Byron. Five timpani and...
Triangle and bass drum and...
Snare.
Snare and glockenspiel and all different kinds of...
Timpani is a whole stable of instruments.
It's a whole stable of itself.
Yes, it is.
It's, and there are just so many different types of...
Well, Orff became famous for the Orff Schulwerk, which is a method of teaching children to... read and to participate in music using instruments. So he percussion instruments. So he developed all these percussion instruments, and the music that he has done is very heavily flavored toward percussion instruments.
Byron, you're not from here.
No.
I know you're from Texas, but
right.
You're not new to Juneau. I've read and heard your name many years. Please tell us, how did you get connected with our community? And then I assume you're the person who chooses this great work each time that it happens. So talk a little bit about your transition to Juneau, Alaska, and your selection process for the group here.
I was doing the Summer Arts Festival in Fairbanks, and I was from the very beginning. In fact, I just recently ceased doing that. But I was doing the festival, and a few people, I think three people from here, came up. Sandra Strantman came up, and... So they decided they would like for me to do something down here. So they contacted me and asked me if I would come, and I said, of course I would come. And so that started, and it started in the winter. We started doing a winter festival. And then we decided we wanted to do something in the summer. And so the summer session has been going on for what?
Oh, 20 years
close
probably.
To 20 years. And so... But the winter festival for 27, I think, 26 or 27. So I've been coming back every year for that long. And at first we were only every other year with the summer. But we started doing Broadway Splash, which we are going to do next summer. That morphed into coming back twice a year and doing a summer thing and doing a winter thing.
Again, talk about, as you prepare to come here, how do you pick what it is that this group, potentially some of whom may be neophytes to the world of singing, how do you decide what the work will be?
One has to consider several things. Number one, do you want to do it? That is the conductor. Is it something that I feel that I want to put my time into? And number two, something that will challenge and yet is accessible to the singer. Number three, is it accessible to the audience to come and do something by the Sinakis or Glass or John Adams here, that we don't have a big enough audience base to make that fly. So those are the three things I consider. And we also get input from the performers. You know, is there something that you've heard that you'd like to hear? Because we use piano, the numbers of larger major works that we can do is limited because they call for orchestra. And it's a piano reduction. And so a lot of that texture and a lot of that timbre, the sound in the mix would depend upon that orchestra. So we look at those things. And then, of course, there have been times where we did Broadway. We do a whole bunch of Broadway things. And those have been extremely popular and well attended. Concerts are well attended. So I use those three criteria. Do I want to do it? And if I say no, then
the other two don't matter.
Right. Because it's going to take a lot of my time and energy beforehand even, because you don't just pick up that score and start doing it. There's a lot of time goes into it. You know, if I really am not familiar or don't really know the score well, that's going to take me 40 hours.
It's a considerable investment of your time. Byron, have you found the Juno group, you've been doing this town for nearly three decades, it sounds like. Have you seen anything about the folks who participate in these events from Juno that might distinguish our community from other communities where you work?
I believe that, you know, there's an attitude here. And the attitude is, if it's going to be done, we've got to do it, because nobody is going to be stopping off in your town on the way to someplace else. And so there's an attitude in the town that by golly, we've got to do it, and we'll try it. There's that pioneer spirit that says, by golly, we'll just try and
we're going
try
for
do
it.
It. And the other thing is that this is a very, very talented and a very, very qualified and educated group of people here. But the attitude to me seems to be that if we want to do something and nobody in town is really top-notch qualified, we'll select the one that is most qualified, and in that process, those people become very qualified. And I've seen that over and over in this state, not just in this town, that people become interested and they get the responsibility and they become world class at doing that. And that's can be demonstrated by the fact that people have gone out of here to do these things. And so, yeah, there is just that attitude that says, we can do this,
we'll get it done. Lena, what organization sponsors the vocal festival?
Juno Lyric Opera. And this is part of our celebration of our 40th anniversary. We've been around for 40 years. I can't believe it. And so we're trying to do a lot of things. We're stretching ourselves this season. One is Carmina, you know, because it's a major work to put together. But we've got lots of things coming down the pike that things that we've done in the past and things that we haven't done in the past, just to celebrate being 40 years old.
Well, congratulations on your anniversary. Let's mention the particulars again, the program and the time and the place. And we haven't said yet where to get some tickets for this.
Well, tickets, of course, you can get at Hearthside Books or at the Jack or on the opera's website, which is junoopera.org. I think it's 18 for adults and 13 for seniors and kids, and lab kids can get in free. And 7:30 Saturday night at Thunder Mountain.
Everybody bring somebody. Every fourth, bring a fifth.
Yes. But, you know, we've got some great soloists. Sarah Radke Brown is the soprano, and Bobby Mitchell is the mezzo, and Brett Crawford is the tenor, and David Miller is the baritone. And they're all sounding great, and it's just going to be lots of fun.
Janice Capel and Sukazama are the pianists.
And it's just, I think people will enjoy themselves. They'll recognize O Fortuna, at least, you know, because it's used so much in advertisements and the movies and that sort
so
of
it
thing.
Will feel familiar.
It feel
sounds
familiar.
Like a raucous, fun evening.
It is a raucous evening. I mean, it really is when the cymbal starts going and the timpani are playing and the two pianos are. I mean, there are a couple of places in it that you take a look at Jan on one piano and Sue on the other, and they're dancing.
They're rocking out.
They're dancing on their piano bench, and the hair is going up and down, and it's really cool.
So the performance is this Saturday evening, 7:30 at Thunder Mountain. You can go online at JunoOpera.org or get your tickets at Hearthside or the Jack. We've been visiting with Lena Simmons and Byron McGilvery about the Midsummer Vocal Festival. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for letting us
be here.
Is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 6th of August, 2015. It was 50 years ago today, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act. 70 years ago today, 1945, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. B-29 bomber Enola Gay released the bomb at 8:16 in the morning. 62,000 buildings destroyed by the blast. 80,000 people were killed on impact. 35,000 over the next week. 60,000 more over the next year. The bomb exploded over a hospital, and 90% of the city's doctors were killed in the blast. The U.S. would drop one more atomic bomb 3 days later on Nagasaki, and then Japan surrendered. A year later, the New Yorker magazine devoted an entire issue to the publication of an article by John Hersey entitled simply Hiroshima, which began at exactly 15 minutes past 8 in the morning on August 6, 1945, Japanese time, at the moment when the atomic bomb flashed above Hiroshima. Miss Toshiko Sasaki, a clerk in the personnel department at the East Asia Tin Works, had just sat down at her place in the plant office and was turning her head to speak to the girl at the next desk. It's the birthday of Sir Alexander Fleming, bacteriologist who discovered the antibacterial properties of penicillin, born in Lochfield, Scotland, 1881. He was looking for something else. At the time, Fleming said, one sometimes finds what one is not looking for. It's the birthday, Boston, 1909, Norma Farber, the children's author best known for the book As I Was Crossing the Boston Common, about a turtle who is the narrator and crossing the park, and he tells about the creatures who go by him, all in alphabetical order. It's the birthday of the historian Richard Hofstadter, Buffalo, 1916, author of 13 books, including The Age of Reform and Anti-Intellectualism in American Life. And it's the birthday of the poet Alfred Lord Tennyson, Lincolnshire, 1809, who gave us the line, 'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all, and there's not to reason why, there's but to do and die.' Here's a poem for today by Barton Sutter, Handyman. The morning brought such a lashing rain, I decided I might as well stay inside and tackle those jobs that had multiplied like an old man's minor aches and pains. I found a screw for the striker plate, tightened the handle on the bathroom door, cleared the drain in the basement floor, and straightened the hinge for the backyard gate. Each task had been a nagging distraction, an itch in the mind, a dangling thread, knocking a tiny brass brad on the head. I felt an insane sense of satisfaction. Then I heard a great crash in the yard. The maple had fallen and smashed our car. Handyman, a poem by Barton Sutter from his collection Farewell to the Starlight in Whiskey, published by Boa Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org/mobile. And by Progressive Insurance, with its APRON project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
And we're back in the studio with Juno Afternoon, Lori Scandling with you here. And with me is Julie Diana. She is the new executive director for Juno Dance Theater, and her partner and husband and coworker, Zach Hinch, who is the artistic director now of the Juno Dance Theater. Welcome to Juno, and welcome to our program. Glad to have you here. You just arrived like 5 days ago, right?
We did. Yes. We got off the ferry last week, and to a warm welcome from JDT waiting for us, and we're thrilled to be here, so thank you for having us on.
You survived, what'd you say, 12 days in an RV with a 7-year-old and a 3-year-old?
We sure.
And a dog and two cats.
Dog and two cats.
Yes.
We loaded everybody up, and it was an epic journey, but it was really wonderful, and we're just thrilled to be settling in and finally here.
So it seems really fortunate that a couple would be able to be hired into a small town, into jobs that are within your field.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of unusual?
I think what's unique about our situation is that when Zach and I met, we were dancing professionally in San Francisco Ballet. And our relationship started as a partnership, you know, on stage and dancing in that way. And it's kind of morphed. After that, we assumed leadership positions at Pennsylvania Ballet as well. And now, you know, stepping into these roles at JDT, it feels like a natural transition for us. And we've always worked well together, and I think we make a pretty good team.
I'd say it's definitely unique, though,
yeah.
As far as, you know, I don't think you see that happen very often where, you know, a husband-wife team are in the same field, and not only that, but hired by the same organizations for two, you know, very big leadership roles and responsibilities. So I think in that way it's definitely unique.
So San Francisco Ballet and Pennsylvania, why Juneau, Alaska? We're probably not in the top 10 of dance capitals in the U.S., although I know there's a huge interest in dance here, having been involved in the past iteration of Juneau Dance Theater and knowing how many young men and women have been involved. But why Juneau? How did you get connected to our community?
Why not Juneau?
Exactly.
We were just so impressed from the minute we got here. And
were you invited to come as performers initially, or to audition for the jobs, or what was the connection?
Well, we were invited to audition for the jobs, and we kind of at first were like, "Yeah, that's Alaska, you know, we're in Pennsylvania,
far
that's
from
very
our
far." And
right.
But the more we thought about it, the more appealing it became, and then when we finally touched down on Alaskan soil, we fell in love from the time the plane landed, you know, just looking out the window. So we're like, wow, what charm. And then every person that we've met has just been great. And it just became more and more of a reality and something that we thought we would be really interested in.
Absolutely. And it's such, we're learning still that, I mean, it's just such a vibrant arts community, and
mm-hmm.
and why wouldn't dance flourish here? And we feel like the organization has tremendous potential. I mean, it's doing so well, and it has a very great following, and we want to build on that, and we want to engage the community further and really enrich the lives of the youth and anyone interested in dance. We're offering a wide variety of classes in our fall schedule, and registration is open, and classes start August 24th. And we really want to, you know, elevate the level of training offering, you know, extensive training in classical ballet, but also theater dance, Zumba, modern children's hip-hop, a new class that Zach's creating.
A few new classes.
Right?
One is ballet for athletes, so anyone that would be interested, not necessarily know anything about ballet, but maybe you want to learn a little bit about ballet while conditioning their bodies. And I have found I was a soccer player and baseball player, and I found that ballet helped me tremendously with my sports and vice versa.
In terms of strength and balance, I would guess.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it's a really nice marriage, and to go ahead and bring that into the community as well, and also offering a choreography workshop, which is something where students will get to create their own choreography and possibly perform it in, you know, the spring performances. So yeah, we're bringing some new things, and we're very into collaborating with people. We want to work with local artists. We have a high school that we're hopefully going to be working on a backdrop, the arts class for our Nutcracker. Also want to collaborate with a local puppeteer on puppets that we want to have made for the Nutcracker as well. So, you know, we're very into engaging the whole community, and we hope to bring that.
Julie, what's the best place for folks to get information about the new fall schedule? I assume that the Juno Dance Theater has a website. What is that?
Yes, junodance.org.
Junodance.org.
Where you can find a wealth of information. Absolutely.
So you use the word potential. Mm-hmm. Tell me one or two things that, say, in the next couple of years you'd like to try out as the new executive director of the JDT.
I'd like to see, as Zach was saying, a lot of collaboration with local arts organizations. We have a wonderful facility on the premises right now that we want to expand into. So we have more space available to us to offer more classes at various times that are accessible to people. And we want to bring in, we have a giant network of colleagues and friends who are very excited about our transition and want to come participate and also lend their expertise and bring their enthusiasm here as well. So we're just kind of waiting until we can extend the invitation and bring all of these artists in, choreographers, dancers, teachers, musicians
yeah.
All kinds of artists. So we want to facilitate all of these relationships and really bring that into Juno.
Where are the JDT studios?
They are
Airport Boulevard.
Yes. Okay. So they're by the airport.
Okay. So you both look young and vigorous.
Thank you.
Why?
I'm just curious
why you are not making dancing your full-time, job still. Have you reached a point physically where you're just surpassed by younger people whose bodies are kind of like an athlete? I mean, being a dancer is like being an athlete when I see them work out.
Mm-hmm.
Is this just the next transitional piece for dancers?
That's a great question.
That is a great question. Zach and I have been very fortunate. We both started dancing professionally at 16 years old, and so we've had over 20 years each of professional dancing experience, and it does take a tremendous toll on your body. And Zach could sit here for an hour talking about all the surgeries.
All the injuries.
Oh, goodness. Okay.
Sprains, breaks, surgeries. Right. I've had like 9 surgeries. Yeah.
Right. But it does.
It catches up with you.
It catches up.
Sure.
It takes a toll. And but at the same time, we learn body maintenance and what it's a very good learning tool as well to learn how to take care of yourself. But yes, it's taxing, and you know, a ballet dancer's career does end, you know, late 30s,
mm-hmm.
And that's where we are right now.
I always crack up, and I think about when you watch the Olympics, and you're watching someone, and they say, oh, they're 24 years old, they're past it, you know, and it's not that extreme in ballet, but it's similar. I mean, you
mm-hmm.
know, it is a young person's
mm-hmm.
game. You can jump higher, you can turn more, you can
mm-hmm.
you have more energy, you have more
fewer
stamina.
Risks, perhaps.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
To compete professionally, but what's so beautiful about the art form is that it really is for everyone. We're offering adult classes, and we invite everyone, no matter what age, open ballet classes, no matter what level, no prior experience, to come in and really feel what the benefits of this discipline can offer, because it's great conditioning for anyone. And even if you have certain limitations, you don't have the turnout, you don't have the, you know, stereotypical aesthetic. Yeah, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's learning the art, experiencing it, expressing yourself, the music, the movement, using it as a tool to analyze, you know, problem solve. It's really beneficial for everyone.
Zach, you're the new artistic director. Mm-hmm. How is dance changing?
Yes. Well, it's changing in a sense that, I mean, it's been around for 100+ years as far as you have your classical ballets, and they will remain the same, and I hope that they do. But I think in order to get new audiences, you have to have a healthy mix of the classical with current things, you know, current music, current choreography, things like that, to keep people interested, to get new audience members in. And then once you get them with that current stuff, then you can hit them with the, you know, the classical stuff and create an appreciation for that as well, for the stuff that's been done for 100 years, because there's such a sense of tradition in that, and what's grandeur, you know, about doing something that's been done for 100 years. I always felt as a dancer when I was dancing Swan Lake, I thought, wow, this is so cool. I'm doing the same thing that someone 100 years ago did. And in that way, that's one of the beautiful things I think about ballet. But again, to engage a newer audience, I think you have to have a healthy blend of everything, of the new and the old.
Well, thank you for joining us today. We're talking with Zachary Hinch and Julie Diana. They are respectively the new artistic director and executive director of Juno Dance Theater. Lots of classes starting August 24th, and you can check out their catalog and what they have to offer online at junodance.org. Good luck to you both, and welcome to Juno.
Thank you.
Thank
so
you very
much.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. In May, we asked listeners to tell us about changes they've seen in the bird life around their homes. One of those who replied is Denise Achai. Dominic Black met up with her at her home in the woods of San Juan Island, an hour off the coast of northwest Washington State, and asked her who first taught her to notice the natural world.
I think it was probably my mother.
What was she like?
Well, my mother was born in Austria in 1917. And she died this spring at a great age. She was an only child, so...
How old was she?
96. She was definitely an outdoors person. She skied, she swam, she
You know, hiked. If I was to ask you what birds mean to you, say, what would you say?
They mean a connection with nature. They give me peace.
What's your favorite bird sound?
Almost any bird in the spring when they're really, you know, when they're just completely intoxicated. The sound, it's the physical manifestation of the way one feels in the spring, you know, new life, hope, promise.
Do you think about your mom when you think about birds?
Sometimes I do, yeah. I always feel that they're sort of a benediction when they come.
A conversation with Bird Note listener Denise Achai. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
And for Juno Afternoon, I'm Lori Scandling with our producer, Jeff Brown. Nancy DeCherney, our every Thursday afternoon guest from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, is here with us, and we're going to talk about what's up. Of course, it's easy, as we said. It's going to be first Friday.
Yes.
And our weather forecast shows that rain will taper off about the time we all want to be walking
perfect.
Around town. So
it's
tell us
perfect.
What it is.
Okay.
Advise us as to a suggested route.
Well, first you come to the Arts Council and pick up your little map, because that will help you guide your steps as you go around. We have one of my favorite pairs of artists. Every other year they're in there, Fumi Matsumoto and Jane Terry. They have their exhibit this month is called Happy Trails,
And with these two artists, it's completely unpredictable. You never know what they're going to do. And so far, it's looking pretty amazing in there. So come by. And, of course, MK has her new grit portrait in there.
What's a grit portrait?
Oh, a grit portrait.
Maybe you won't tell me, but I am interested.
Yes, yes. Every Monday, MK does a new portrait of somebody here in town. She's going to do 52 of these. We're coming, closing in on it. This week's portrait is Paul Hamby. He's a logger and firefighter. So his biography is there, and you can see a slideshow of her previous portraits. But it's amazing. She does this every week. Comes in at noon on Monday, so you can meet the people if you want to.
Very fun. Will that be then on display tomorrow?
Because MK, as you will find out, as I will subsequently reveal, will be having
in due time.
Yes, her own First Friday thing. So at COPA, it is recent works by Amanda Falore, and her show is it's a lot of stuff about musicians and music because that's sort of her background. And that show will be up through August, and then, as I mentioned, MK will have her own studio, which is at the corner of Front and Main. It's called Sketch, and there's actually a parking lot there, and you go behind Kenny's Wok and Teriyaki, and the door is there. You'll see it open, and she's going to be having new works and treats, and she's been working on these tiny little portraits or little tiny paintings, and those will be available. So just stop in. She has the most amazing stuff. Annie Kales is going to be featuring original works from Byron Birdsall and his daughter Courtney Birdsall Clifford. So stop in there. That exhibit will be up through August as well. I want to just put a shout out to Annie Kales, who's getting a Mayor's Awards for the Art, for their 40 years of supporting and promoting Alaskan artists such as Byron. So do come by to the Arts Council on the 21st and say hello and thank you. The Silver Bow Backroom has Ink on Paper by Lindsay Carone. I don't know if I'm saying her last name right. It could be Karen. She's always capturing the essence of what is depicted and the spirit that bring the spirit forward with energy and beauty, it says. So stop in there. And again, that one's up through August. But nonetheless, it's more fun to be out there with everybody else looking around. So do that. On Seward Street, the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in the Walter Soboloff Center will have Rhonda Butler, Renee Culp, Selena Beerley, and the Nation's Children will be performing. So it's free admittance for that period of time. So stop in there. There's going to be special discounts in their store.
They have a gorgeous gift store there.
Gorgeous everything there. So Sequence Board Shop, DJ Quilts, and also some local art will be there. They are on Seward Street, and we've got the GCI downtown is having the Baby Box Project. So
we talked about that a couple of weeks ago.
The Canvas has Jim Fowler, and the Juno Artist Gallery is featuring Charles and Paula Rohrbacher. And Kindred Post has a photo booth, Levitation. So if you're feeling a little down, Pat Race will bring you back up. That's right. Out in the valley, you can go to the Northern Tea House and see Mandy Johnson, and go to Art Matters and see her Bonet. So there's a lot of stuff going on out there in the
Good to know we're stretching it out a bit. Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, as a matter of fact, Byron Birdsall and Courtney Birdsall will be here to talk about the Annie Kales Show. We'll get an update from the Treadwell Ice Arena with Laura Anderson. We'll find out about the next Jump Society show, and we'll get details about the Juno Museum Juno Explorers program. That's tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno.